The Agriculture, Conservation, and Resiliency Committee will now come to order. Missy, please call the roll.
Chair Buchanan?
Here.
Vice Chair Roth? Ranking Member Skidmore?
Here.
Representative Abbott?
Here.
Representative Alvarez?
Here.
Representative Antone?
Here.
Representative Bartleman?
Here.
Representative Botana?
Here.
Representative Brackett?
Here.
Representative Bisada Cabrera? Representative Cassell?
Here.
Representative Cheney?
Here.
Representative Esposito?
Here.
Representative Hunchowski?
Here.
Representative Mooney?
Here.
Representative Steele?
Here.
Representative Trunau?
Here.
Representative Tuck?
Here.
Thank you, Missy. Members, in announcements, I just want to remind everyone to make sure you turn off your electronic devices or move them to silent for the duration of our meeting today. Members, I know it's late in the afternoon and early in the week, but I think we have a great couple presentations today where we're going to talk a little bit about resiliency. For some of you that weren't here a couple sessions ago when we passed the historic legislation, the Always Ready legislation, this is something that'll really be helpful in giving you some background around the resiliency issue in the state of Florida, and also inform us as we, as policymakers, look to the future. So today, what we'll have is two presentations. Up first, we'll have the Florida Flood Hub for Applied Research and Innovation, which is housed in the University of South Florida's College of Marine Science. The presentation will be given by Dr. Tom Frazier, who is an executive director of the Flood Hub, as well as the dean of the college. Members, for those of you that don't know, I also got my graduate degree from USF, so it's a great program over there. We're going to have Dr. Frazier come on up, and we're going to recognize him for his presentation. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Chairman Buchanan. Go Bulls.
Go Bulls.
Proud of you. All right. So I am going to talk a little bit about the Flood Hub for Applied Research and Innovation. And I'm going to kind of talk specifically about some of the more recent work that we've been doing. So this will probably be a little more science than this committee is used to, but hopefully you'll have a good time with it. And there'll be plenty of questions. So do I advance the slides or? Oh, clicker right here. All right, so as the chairman pointed out, the Flood Hub for Applied Research and Innovation is hosted by the University of South Florida's College of Marine Science, and it's really intended to serve as Florida's center for flood-related data. All right, so the Flood Hub was created by statute, thank you for that, and provided with base funding from the state of Florida, and it's intended really to serve as a premier thought leader on research related to flooding to help Floridians plan and prepare for the impacts of sea level rise, extreme rainfall events, and stronger, and importantly, more costlier storms. So the Flood Hub serves as a foundational partner that has collaborations that support both local, regional, and state governments across the state. And as these entities certainly incorporate future flood risk into their planning and adaptation initiatives. So accordingly, we work very closely with the folks in the EP and the Resilient Florida program. So to achieve its objectives, the Florida Flood Hub relies pretty heavily on scientific and technical working groups. And it's these work groups that are really at the heart of the Flood Hub. So we have scientists and other subject matter experts that convene regularly to address issues such as sea level rise, high tide flooding, storm surge, and extreme rainfall events. And the work groups really concentrate their expertise to fill gaps in data, evaluate models, and create new models where appropriate. They solve scientific problems, and they generally advance our understanding of the risks that are associated with flooding that can occur as a result of multiple factors. You know, so the issue of compound flooding, which I'm sure most everybody in this room is aware of, is certainly on top of mind as we move forward with our efforts. As I said before, the Flood Hub is collaborative by design, and the Flood Hub relies heavily on the strength of its partnerships to ensure that our work has real-world impact. Other partner groups include, but are not limited to, universities, water management districts, utility providers, regional planning councils, resiliency coalitions and other, say, scientific agencies, either at the state or federal level. And we, of course, as I said before, work very closely with the Resilient Florida program to accomplish our mission, and we maintain really strong ties with both the chief science officer, state chief science officer, as well as the state's chief resilience officer. So with the time that I have today, I was hoping that I could focus specifically, as I said before, on some of the work being out carried, some of the work being carried out by the Sea Level Rise group. So let's talk about an initial effort. And, you know, so it's important to note that the Sea Level Rise work group worked with data that was released by the federal task force in 2022. So we didn't create any new data, right? We used all the raw data that was available across the nation, and we consider that the best scientific information available, and that's important to understand. So what was the difference here is that the Florida Flood Hub simply focused on Florida, and what they did is they used the gridded data, and that's what you see in this figure here, to create a Florida-specific regional data set to develop an appropriate set of sea level rise or estimates or projections across the state. And so why do we do this, right? When the federal task force looked at the data, they created separate regions. And no fault of their own, the federal government has different priorities sometimes than we do and different foci, but so they essentially created a region in the northeastern Gulf of Mexico and one in the southeast Atlantic. So it essentially split the peninsula of Florida right down the middle. And so the working group was concerned that when you looked at data for either the west coast of Florida or the east coast of Florida, you wouldn't get an accurate representation of what was going on here because, as we all know, in the northern Gulf of Mexico, there's a great deal of land subsidence and vertical land motion that bias those estimates higher, right? And similarly, you see some things like that on the east coast of Florida. So, In any case, what we did is we looked at the sea level rise scenarios, five different scenarios, from low to high. These are generally accepted scenarios. And we looked at those scenarios over three different time horizons, what's going to happen in 2040, what's going to happen in 2050, and what's going to happen in 2070. And the work group also provided So why that's important, let me step back for just a second. So when they provide those estimates, that actually provides you with an idea, right, or an estimate of the magnitude of the problem or the risk, right? But the group also looked at the exceedance probabilities for each of these time horizons in various scenarios. And this will become apparent when I show you the next table, right? But by looking at those exceedance probabilities and tying them to the estimates, which is the magnitude, we can actually get a better idea of the likelihood, right, of something occurring, you know, exceeding a particular scenario. So you need both the magnitude and the likelihood, right, to make risk-based decisions. So this is what the data look like, right? So these, again, are the initial estimates. Again, based on the best scientific information available. So the values in this table are for those five sea level rise scenarios that I talked about going from low to high. And on the top of the table are three different time horizons, 2040, 2050, 2070. And the values in the table are given in both in millimeters and inches, okay, for each of those specific time horizons. Recognize sea level rise scenarios. So what you can see, if you pay attention to the table, right, that there's clearly a divergence in the values as you extend the time horizons, regardless of the sea level rise scenario. As you go out further in time, you're going to go, for example, for the low sea level rise scenario here, and by the 2040 time horizon, you can expect to see 7.8 inches of relative sea level rise, but by 2070, it becomes 13.1 inches, right? Similarly, if you to look at the scenarios themselves, you know, the higher sea level rise scenario obviously results in a higher relative sea level rise, and by 2070 you can see that the projection or the estimated value is 38 inches, all right? So again, these data are the data underlying these estimates are exactly the same that were used by in the Federal Task Force report. They were simply aggregated specifically for Florida. But what you will notice is, as expected by the working group, that these estimates are lower than those provided in the task force report, okay, in the federal report. So that's the magnitude of the risk. And I want to go back now to this issue of the likelihood of risk. And so in this particular table is what you have, in this table you have a series of exceedance probabilities for these same five scenarios. And so it's important, again, to note that these scenarios are often tied to carbon emission pathways. Sometimes they're simply tied to temperature. And we chose, for the purposes of this talk, to provide them to you in terms of temperature. But, you know, the low sea level rise scenario is generally associated with a suite of low carbon emissions, so it's, you know, relatively optimistic, right? And the high sea level rise scenario is generally associated with high carbon emissions and is more pessimistic in nature. So low carbon emissions, of course, result in smaller relative temperature changes or relative global mean temperatures over time. So I'm gonna come back to these two tables. I realize there's a lot, but I'm gonna kind of speak to a couple of things. So in this particular case, what the working group did is they focused on the global mean surface air temperature increases of 2 and 3 degrees C. Why did they do that? Right, they did that because those are the most likely temperatures that are that you can expect to see by 2100, given the current carbon emission pathways that we're on, right? So we're not making any statements about what's going to happen down the road. These involve carbon emission mitigation measures that are currently in place as of 2020. And so we looked at 2 and 3 degrees C specifically. And again, we focused on intermediate low and the intermediate sea level rise scenarios. They're bolded in gray here. And the reason that we did that is because when you look at the low sea level rise scenario or the intermediate or the high scenario, you can see that the exceedance probabilities are quite high, right? Either there's a high likelihood of exceeding them, as in you have in the case of the low scenario, or in the intermediate or high sea level rise scenarios, there's an extremely low case of exceeding that. So what we're trying to do is take this data, make it useful for policymakers and planners, right? And by giving them, pointing them to the most likely scenarios that we can anticipate moving forward. So when you look, now I'm going to bring you back to the data itself, right? These are the estimates. And so when we think about focusing on the intermediate low and the intermediate sea level rise scenarios, what you can see is in kind of the most optimistic case by 2040, we might see 8.9 inches of sea level rise in Florida, right? So and in a more pessimistic case, perhaps, in the intermediate scenario by 2070, we might see as much as 21.6 inches, right? And these are generally applied across the state of Florida. And one other important thing is that all of these sea level rise estimates are relative to the year 2000. And so we have to keep in mind that we've already experienced about 3.5 to 4 inches of sea level rise, which are part of these estimates, okay, moving forward. So in this case, for example, at the 2070 time horizon for the intermediate scenario, we might expect to see 21.6 inches. But again, we've already achieved or observed 3.5 to 4 inches, so more along the lines of 16 inches by 2070. All right. So why do we care about all of this? Clearly, sea level rise is a concern for the state of Florida. We're kind of ground zero for many of these issues, particularly as they relate to coastal flooding. But they affect all facets of our life, right? They affect our transportation infrastructure. That means roads and bridges. They affect our utility systems, our energy, and our grids. They have huge impacts for how we design and develop our stormwater systems moving forward. You know, know, they have effects as well as when we're thinking about protecting our shorelines, whether it's with gray or green infrastructure. And, of course, there's a ton of other assets that exist in the coastal zone in the state of Florida, and I think we're all aware of that. But as we think about investments moving forward, you know, where are we going to make those investments? What's the risk? That's why we provide these data to the state of Florida. So what are the next steps? I think this is an important first step for us, but we realized after talking with stakeholders that there's probably broader interest in a more complete set of time horizons. We gave 2040, 2050, and 2070 because that's what was indicated that we do in the legislative language. But after talking to folks with the various agencies, we're going to provide the same estimates at decadal intervals all the way up to 2150. And I think that'll, again, be of greater benefit. We recognize that high tide flooding events continue to be a problem. Sea level rise will certainly exacerbate those high tide flooding events, particularly in southeast Florida and parts of southwest Florida. And so the group's already moving forward with that effort so we can provide residents in those counties and other stakeholders appropriate forecasting. And then, again, one of the missions of the Flood Hub is to coordinate not only with state agencies and other resilience-oriented groups, but federal agencies as well. We've worked with NOAA, which is at the federal level, leveraged this findings to garner a new project that will allow us to densify the tide gauge network around Florida. That will allow us to look more closely at localized sea level rise levels. That will be important. And then we're also looking at this idea of contributions of regional ocean processes. And so, again, this may be too much in the weeds. You can scale me back, Chairman, if you want. But I think it's important, right? So when we're talking about sea level rise projections, we're using global climate models, right? And those global climate models are essentially the force signal. It's a temperature-driven signal. But that temperature change has pretty serious or potential serious consequences for ocean circulation and atmospheric dynamics. And so in Florida, that means there's changes potentially in the Gulf Stream. You know, on the West Coast, there's changes in the loop current. And all of those can affect, again, the transfer of energy and heat into the atmosphere. And because we're a peninsular state, that has huge effects for convective kind of rainfall and things like that. So we're going to move forward with that because the global data would suggest, right, that those regional processes aren't operating in Florida. But we do see some deviations, and it's a potential blind spot, and I think we can make that scientific investment to better inform what's going on in the state. So, I think I was going to talk about the rainfall group, but in the interest of time, I'd like to have a little discussion if you're interested.
Dr. Fraser, you're welcome to talk a little bit about rainfall as well, because
okay, so we
very well may be a question.
Yeah, so we have a number of working groups. As I mentioned, this was the work primarily coming out of the Sea Level Rise Working Group. But we are working now. We have a rainfall working group. They're very focused on extreme rainfall events. I think based on what happened in Fort Lauderdale this past spring, I think we're all well aware of what can happen there. We've taken what's called change factors. It's essentially trying to get a better idea of how the magnitude or the duration and the amount of rainfall that occurs in an event, how that might change with time. And so there's been a good bit of work done in South Florida on this, but this working group's been able to work with the USGS in partnership to extend those change factors in the approach to develop a series of statewide data that will help, again, agencies that are interested in trying to look at what happens with precipitation patterns in the future. So we've got a couple of issues when we talk about precipitation. There's certainly seasonal changes in precipitation. We're going to have, you know, wet years and dry years or more drought periods or wetter time periods. But we're also going to have daily events, an increase in the likelihood of extreme rainfall events, not only on the daily scale, but on the sub-daily scale as well. And so in order to be able to predict what those look like or the likelihood of occurrence so we can incorporate that into our forecasting. That's the focus of this particular group right now. So anyways, I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you for that presentation, Dr. Frazier. Members, do we have any questions? Representative Anton, you're recognized.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the great presentation. A quick question. We divided the state up into four parts, the Panhandle, Big Bend, Southwest, and the East Coast. Which of those four areas faces the greatest threat of sea level rise?
I think, again, the conclusions coming from the work group right now is that sea level rise is relatively uniform across the state of Florida from all the way in the Panhandle, all the way around to kind of Jacksonville. So, again, when you're talking, the actual magnitude of increase is probably not going to differ, right? The threat is going to depend on the investment of and what exists in those areas. So, again, I think just by virtue of being a very metropolitan area, I think parts of Southeast and Southwest Florida are going to experience the most exposure.
Follow up? Members, questions? Vice Chair Roth, you're recognized.
Dr. Frazier, thank you for this report. I do have a couple of questions. One of them just very simple, seems like a good starting question. You talked about global climate change, global climate models. We learned a lot with the pandemic that some of the predictions on how the pandemic was going to play out turned out not to be true. They ended up being overly aggressive and saying there was going to be a lot more deaths than there actually were. The concern most people have about the global climate change scenario is a better understanding of whether the models that people are talking about and the ones they're presenting data to the United Nations and all that, that these models are actually working. I've heard stories that there was a pause for like 20 years from 1980 to 2000 where the temperature actually didn't go up. So could you just speak in general to are some of the models actually able to, you know, accurately give some prediction? Because it's a very complex system that we're talking about. We're not talking about just carbon dioxide. We're talking about water vapor and all kinds of other factors.
Dr. Frazier, recognized, and maybe you could talk a little bit about the models that are being used.
Yeah, okay, I appreciate that. So thank you, Representative Roth. So again, and I'll step back a little bit and tell you, I want to focus on something that we did, and it's essentially acknowledged.
Please speak into the mic too. So, yeah, thank you.
Gotcha. So you'll recall from my presentation that this work group, the sea level rise work group from the Flood Hub, focused on two scenarios, given a projected increase, temperature increase by 2100 of 2 to 3 degrees C, right? That's a subset of the scenarios that are out there and available to the public, right? So in many cases, in the IPCC reports, for example, or in the Federal Task Force reports, they have a slightly different mission or goal than we have in the Flood Hub. What they do is they provide the full suite or range of scenarios, right? And they're not necessarily providing guidance on which one you need to pay attention to. So as a consequence of that, for example, a lot of people will gravitate to the fact that, you know, those high emission scenarios, in the old days they used RCPs of 8.5s, you know, now they use SSPs that are similar. But and if you look at those scenarios, you might in fact see pretty extreme increases in sea level rise, you know, in some cases 3 meters or more. What we recognize is that those are scenarios and they're modeled, right, and they're supported by the models. But they're also very unlikely, right? And the degree of uncertainty surrounding those models is quite high, right? So we feel very confident with these data that we're providing to Florida as the most likely. And I think we have a high degree of confidence, particularly in those shorter time horizons from 2040 to 2070, you know, which affects a lot of the investments that we will make or specific projects over that time.
Vice Chair Roth with a follow-up.
Yes, sir, Chair. So you didn't answer the question directly, but you feel like you do have some confidence. So could you tell us, maybe you said there was 3.5 to 4 inches of sea level rise that we've already experienced in Florida. So could you kind of go backwards from where we are today and give us maybe a little bit of a timeline and say, this is what has actually occurred over the last, whatever, 50 years? I mean, that's what I don't fully understand, is how much sea level rise have we had to date, you know? And
Dr. Fraser, you have a little bit more? You're recognized, and of course, you could go way back in time. You know, sea levels have gone up hundreds of feet before, you know, humans have had any really impact. But talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I apologize if I didn't answer directly your question. I wasn't trying to avoid it. So I'm going to go back first to make sure that I'm clear, right? There are a broad suite of scenarios that are supported by, you know, various models, and sometimes there's tens of thousands of iterations of those models, right? And whenever you run that many models, you're going to have the full suite of extremes. And all of those things are statistically possible, but when you look at all the contributions, for example, to sea level rise, like vertical land motion, ice melt, changes in air temperature, thermal expansion, and things of that nature, those extreme events, which some people will identify with, right, are those extreme scenarios and talk about, they're highly uncertain and probably very unlikely, right? So I'm hoping I'm directly answering your question there. So with regard to the history of sea level rise, certainly there has been, over the scale of thousands and 10,000 of years or longer, wide variations in sea level rise and global air temperatures, right? And, you know, we can expect that over geologic time as well. The important thing about what's going on in now, right, is those air temperatures, right, are increasing at a rate faster than we've ever seen in geologic history, right? So that's the concern. It's not that things haven't oscillated over time. It's the rate of change that's unprecedented, right? And so what we've seen in Florida relative to the baseline, which we set at 2000, right, is in the last 23 years, about 3.5 to 4 inches of observed sea level rise around the state of Florida. And so what can we expect under the low, intermediate low, over the next 20 years? About the same. You know, and we have, again, fairly good confidence in those estimates in the near-term horizons. It's when you get out to 2100 and 2150 that we're less confident about those estimates, and we'd like to restrict our analysis to things that we're going to be working on in the near and immediate term.
Thank you. Sir, can I just ask one simple question? It's almost a yes or no answer. Can I ask one more?
Go ahead.
So on one of the graphs, it says a low 7.8 inches to 2040, 9.8 inches to 2050. Does that mean that you would read that to say it's 2 inches, could be 2 inches more in another 10 years? I'm just trying to understand how to read that when you say 7.8 inches, 2040, and 9.8 inches. You're saying 2 inches in 10 years.
Dr. Fraser, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's exactly what I'm saying, right? And so, again, for those of you who aren't familiar with the way that they derived or came at these sea level rise scenarios, they're largely arbitrary, right, in the sense that the low sea level rise scenario is assuming, you know, what if you achieved 0.3 meters of sea level rise by 2100? You know, in contrast, the high sea level rise scenario is all about what if you achieved 2 meters of sea level rise by 2100? So in this particular case, we know, right, and with a great deal of confidence, what's going to happen in the near term. But as those values, those projections move forward, we become less uncertain. But the implication is exactly what you're getting at. In the short term, you know, the next decade or two decades, you know, fairly steady state of sea level rise. By the end of the century, if given the models, we expect that those rates to accelerate.
Representative Cheney with a question.
Thank you, Chair Buchanan. Have you had any coordination with regional floodplain managers in your predictions and what theirs are?
Dr. Frazier, you're recognized.
Again, thank you, Mr. Chair. So we work oftentimes with regional planning councils, regional coalitions, and we have talked, I've certainly talked with individuals from those groups about these projections quite a bit, yes.
Follow up. And so are you in agreement? And if not, where is the discrepancy?
I think that we are in agreement with the science that underlies the projections or the estimates themselves. You're saying no, we're not in agreement?
Clarification, Mr. Chair?
Clarification, go ahead.
Thank you. So specifically on the inches of sea level rise, because as you pointed out, this has to do with planning for transportation, community development. So all that really matters is how much are you saying we're going to have for sea level rise? And are your predictions in line with community floodplain managers? And if not, where's the discrepancy? Are
Dr.
yours
Frazier.
That there's more sea level rise or less than our floodplain managers?
Dr. Frazier, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think that the estimates or the volumes themselves don't vary radically, right? I'm going to be very careful here. I think the discrepancy arises in the amount of risk tolerance when you're considering these types of infrastructure projects. So I don't think there's a debate about the data themselves. It's more about risk tolerance, right? And again, so you have to look at the numbers, which is the estimate, the magnitude of potential sea level rise, as well as the probability of exceeding a particular estimate. So again, one of the things that's important to recognize about the Flood Hub is we're fairly agnostic about that. What we're trying to do is to provide the best data possible for all of those who might need to use it for their purposes, right, and provide the best guidance available about how to evaluate and assess risk. So I think some of the consternation comes in where your risk tolerance is, but it's the Flood Hub that's not making those decisions.
Thank you, Dr. Frazier. Representative Cheney, you good? You want another one? Take
how
another
about
shot.
It?
So risk tolerance is based on estimates of sea level rise.
In part, that's the magnitude, right? But then you have to ask yourself, well, what's the likelihood of exceeding a particular projected value at any given time? And so, for example, if I might, let me see if I can go back here to a slide. So in this particular case, right, so you've got, I've highlighted intermediate low and intermediate high. And the reason that I did that is because if you were going to put let's say we're going to build a culvert, a bridge or something with a 10-year or 20-year lifespan, and I said, okay, well, there's a 50% probability of exceeding that. So if I was fairly risk-averse, right, and it wasn't an expensive project, I might opt to do that.
Representative Steele with the question.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Do you guys differentiate between water displacement versus snowmelt?
Dr. Frazier, you're recognized.
Yeah, thank you. So so when you look at the models, right, that underlie the projections, they're comprised of a number of component parts, like say displacement or expansion is one of those, right? Ice melt is another. So those are a couple of different things. But they are component parts. So we're incorporating all of those component parts into these estimates, as did the National Task Force.
Representative Steele with a follow-up.
Thank you, Chair. Just clarification. I'm referring to fact now. You said that it's risen three inches. On the 3 inches that we have now, no modeling, no future predictions. Do you guys differentiate between displacement versus melt.
Dr.
Like
Frazier, recognize.
Volcanic islands, you know, eruptions underneath the sea that's going to displace the water.
So I'm not trying to evade the question. All I'm saying is that those types of things, right, are it's the sea level rise projections, that 3.5 to 4 inches that's already been observed, is a combination of all of those things, right, to date. And moving forward, those same contributing factors will figure in to future sea level rise increases. We can look at specific component parts, and we will, one of those being vertical land motion or subsidence, right? In some cases, subsidence. In some cases, there may be uplift, right? Because I think that's important, because vertical land motion can be affected by regional or local scale processes, and there's a need to pay attention to that.
Dr. Frazier, I have one quick question, then we'll move on to our ranking member for a question. To what extent do we understand in the state of Florida inland flooding and the way that water moves across the state?
Yeah, again, I mean, Florida is a hydrologically and hydrodynamically complicated state, right? I think we understand, we continue to increase and improve our what they call H&H models, hydrologic and hydraulic models, to better understand how water moves across the surface. But we recognize there's a couple of issues in Florida and why we have not just coastal flooding but inland flooding, right? We are seeing some changes in precipitation patterns that can lead to increased frequency of extreme rainfall events. When that happens because of changes in land cover and land use over time, it affects the way that water moves across that surface, right? In some cases, it can overwhelm our current stormwater systems, our water conveyance systems, and that's why we can get some flooding. So there's certainly a need to rethink and improve, where necessary, ways to convey water across the state of Florida, because inland flooding will continue to be a problem. It's not just a coastal problem.
Thank you for that answer, Dr. Frazier. Ranking Member Skidmore, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Does the flood hub or do the flood hub predictions take into account any type of mitigation efforts that are being made, or are there recommendations other than just the data that are being presented?
Dr. Frazier, recognized.
Thank you. So just wanted to back up again and say, so the flood hub's not making recommendations about mitigation measures per se. In the data that were provided, anticipated increases in temperature over time are those that are expected based on the mitigation measures that are in place by 2020 globally. Great.
Ranking Member, do you have a follow-up, or are you good?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just saying I apologize if that was answered already and I missed it. There was a lot of information.
I try to be clear, and so, and again, if there are any questions after this, I'm happy to sit and talk with anybody.
Thank you for that, Dr. Frazier. Representative Mooney for a question.
Thank you, Chair. Good to see you again.
Good to
twice
see you.
In a week. So, you know, with all the data that's been presented, obviously, correct me if I'm wrong, I think this data really is truly intended to help the state of Florida become more resilient to whatever, for whatever reasons, we have increases in water levels. I mean, a couple of years ago, we had a big nor'easter set off up the New England coast, big low pressure center, and slowed the Gulf Stream down to a crawl, which kept king tides in motion for an extra month down in South Florida. So we know that for whatever reasons that the water rises and subsides, that's not really truly the issue here. The issue is, can we prepare ourselves for a worst case scenario while hoping for a best case scenario? And if so, I would ask you that your focus is really what on infrastructure upgrades and resiliency, both gray and green, to help combat all of those as we hope for, prepare for the worst and hope for the best. Is that the goal here?
Yeah. Dr. Fraser, you're recognized.
Sorry. Again, what I would say is that the goal of the Flood Hub is to provide the best scientific information available to Florida and its stakeholders, right? We're not a decision-making body. The best thing that I feel like we can do for any decision maker is to provide them the best information so they can make well-informed decisions, right? I'm not judging the decisions that are to be made, but I can certainly help evaluate those decisions and talk about the consequences of picking one pathway or another. But that's not my choice. What's important for the state of Florida is to have good quality data to base their decisions on.
Thank you, Dr. Fraser. Members, any more questions? See no further questions. Thank you very much for that presentation.
There you go. Thank you very much, Chairman.
Up next, we're going to be hearing from the American Flood Coalition, of which they'll be giving a presentation. Who will be providing it will be Melissa Roberts. Melissa Roberts, hi. You're recognized at the podium. Thank you for being here with us today.
Wonderful. Thank you. Big thank you, Chairman Buchanan, who's been such a leader on these issues. I thank you for inviting me here and for all you've done. And thank you to the committee for inviting this presentation. And I'd be remiss if I started any presentation on resilience in the state of Florida without a big thank you to Representatives Bucero Cabrada, Hunchofsky, and Cheney, who have really, I think, led the way in helping Florida to be one of truly the most resilient cutting-edge states on these issues. So I'll just start a little bit on who we are and why I feel confident making that assessment that Florida is such a leader as someone in a nonprofit who works across states all across the country, a little bit on some of the flooding impacts, the role of state government, and why you all in this room are so incredibly important for the fate of Florida, all of what Florida's achieved, and kind of where Florida can go next, continuing as a leader. So just by way of introduction, the American Flood Coalition's a nonpartisan coalition advocating for policy solutions for flooding and sea level rise. And we're really a coalition of what I like to say is all the folks on the front lines of flooding. So cities and towns, elected officials at all levels, businesses, military leaders, civic groups, and federal champions in Congress as well. And while we're active in 22 states, I would definitely say that Florida, for us, is the first among equals. Our coalition includes 8 members of Congress from Florida, 139 Florida members, including 70 local government members, and numerous pilots on the ground actually helping with projects. And I will say that the work across states really makes it clear, you know, how much Florida has done, especially in the last 3 years, because as we go to all of those other states in blue on the map, we're often pointing to the work you all have done here as an excellent example. So I think before we talk about resilience, it's helpful to just set the stage for why we're talking about this and why it matters. So as many of you know, flooding's the most costly and most common natural disaster in the U.S., and Florida is one of the states, of course, most at risk in feeling that. I think many of you have felt that yourselves or heard about it in your districts. And in Florida, the data tells us, you know, over 1/3 of all properties have a greater than 26% chance of being severely affected by flooding over the course of an average mortgage, so over that 30 years. But the good news is that we know that every dollar invested in flood protection saves up to $7 in recovery costs. And those investments that you all have made here have already started to bear fruit and show that return, and will continue to do so. So the reason I'm so excited to be in front of you all today is because really when it comes to flooding, even though we work at the local, state, and federal level, the state is really the most important, truly the linchpin for flood action. So the actions you all have taken and continue to take are so incredibly important. Why? Because water doesn't follow political boundaries. We know that it does not stop, you know, when you reach the municipal line, so we have to be thinking about this at a broader state scale. We know also that states are the ones that can coordinate large-scale flood protection. States receive and allocate most of the federal funding for this. That robust statewide approaches can really be leveraged by local communities. And most importantly, and I'm sure many of you have experienced this in your districts, most local governments truly can't effectively manage flooding without state support and state programs. So the work that you all do here in this room is so incredibly important for the fate of Florida. And, you know, I love to look back and just say, you know, Always Ready was such an incredible turning point for Florida, thanks to the work that many of you here have done. And this is something that, again, as a group that works nationally, we point to in other states as an incredible investment. So thinking about just the scale of what this means, I'll get into some of the stats on the next slide, but I think it's really important to highlight, many of you, of course, know this well and made it happen, but I think looking at this as not just the flood protection, but what it meant for the economic future, the fact that S&P credited the actions that you all have taken here, the creation of the Chief Resilience Officer, the investment in Resilient Florida, as a noted factor in supporting the AAA plus bond rating in 2021 is pretty remarkable. They don't often comment on that, and it's rare that you get credit for this type of investment. And so I think this is, you know, a nice outward validation about how much this is noted, what a leading program you all have created, and how much, you know, reward you get for these types of investments, not just in the actual projects that those investments fund, but in the fact that it helps maintain a strong bond rating, because those agencies, of course, are looking for risks, and if they see that you are tackling those risks head on in a smart and fiscally responsible way, you get credit for it. So just to recap and kind of, you know, really validate, I think, the incredible work that's been done here. You know, there's been landmark legislative achievements just since 2020. So consistent and recurring grant funding, the creation of the Florida Flood Hub, the state legislative committee with a dedicated resilience purpose, all of you right here, and of course, the dedicated statewide Chief Resilience Officer in Dr. Wes Brooks. And I'll mention, you know, we got into a lot of the details of the Florida Flood Hub, but I'll say as someone who works across states, one of the things that's really great about having something like a flood hub is that there's obviously a lot of work and care that goes into trying to create the right data that's specific to Florida rather than global or national and is publicly accessible. And getting to do that once instead of reinventing the wheel 411 times in each municipality is really a prudent and fiscally responsible approach, right? To make that available and then let people choose. And that's something that we're seeing more and more states adopt, and Florida's really been a leader. We've seen South Carolina move and try to copy this model in Florida, and we've seen others moving in that direction. And I will also say, you know, that chart in the middle on the dedicated funding for resilience is incredible, right? Going from 20 million to over 300 million roughly annually. Of course, we've seen that demand for projects continues to far outstrip the funding, so it's important to continue, but this is incredible progress. And what has it resulted in? I think it's most important when we talk about this to really acknowledge that this is real projects turning dirt in districts, right? It's 227 local planning grants to date, as well as 147 actual infrastructure projects going in the ground, you know, all across the state. So, but I think it's important to know that, you know, there's a lot of good progress that's been made, But of course, there's more to do because of that part I mentioned in the beginning, of course, that you all live, which is Florida's incredibly at risk. So when we think about this as a group that works, you know, across states and nationally, we really think about five main questions that, you know, state legislators like you can ask as you come up with a strategy for resilience. The first is around leadership and accountability. You want to be able to answer who's in charge, right? Who's the captain of the ship? And you want to be able to point to someone. The second is really understanding that data and risk assessment piece. So knowing what's at risk, that's kind of your chart. If you're going to set out on a voyage, you want to have, you know, your chart to look at. The third is your strategic planning element. So to know there's a lot of things that you can do, but what should you prioritize? And that's kind of planning your route, setting your course, right? The fourth, of course, is funding and financing. How do we pay for this? That's always the most important question. And that's, you know, how do we fund our voyage, our expedition? And then the fifth is statewide standards. How do we make sure that we're really securing long-term change and that we're not setting off on our voyage in a boat that has, you know, a bunch of leaks that's making it hard to get to our destination? And I think when we look at this for Florida, there are areas where we have really clear answers to these questions because of the great work you've all done. And then there's some places where, you know, it really helps lead us towards what you could do next and what you could think about. And I think ultimately, you know, the conclusion I take from this is there's been incredible work and progress here, and you don't want to take your foot off the pedal. You don't want to kind of slow down because there's a lot more to continue to do. And I will say, you know, I often get asked, what are other states doing outside of Florida? And I'll say, Florida's in really good company. Other states like Texas are making similar statewide investments with a regional focus the way Florida is, and really prioritizing this. So in a place like Texas, you know, we see 90 FTEs at the Texas Water Development Board, $40 million for statewide mapping, a Texas state flood plan due out next year, $1.4 billion invested, and statewide flood disclosure, which is all to say there's a lot they can learn from what you all have done. There's a lot that you can look to others, but I think, you know, Florida is not the only state grappling with this, and there are many other states that are kind of grappling with these same trends and making these investments. So where could you go next? What does this look like? So I'll lay out a couple ideas that we've seen from our work across states, building on the incredible work that's been done. I think the first is, you know, a state investment in a clear picture of risk. So the idea would be, how do you give Florida and all of you who are making decisions a really clear look at flood risk across the state and the cost of lowering it to acceptable levels? Why would you want to do this? Because you want to make it easier for you all to compare apples to apples and get to invest in quality projects in the highest risk areas and really steward tax dollars well. So how can you do this? You know, ensure regional high-quality modeling connected to entities like the Flood Hub and informing a real statewide view. The other piece, of course, is thinking about that high-quality, consistent data. And if we go back to my somewhat tortured boat metaphor, I would say this is making sure the charts are consistent, right? If you're setting out, you don't want to be looking at two different charts that are pointing you in different directions. You want the same understanding so that you can make decisions. And so this is thinking about making sure agencies and units of government really have access to the same high-quality data and projections, and they're not using different timescales and different assumptions. Why? Because effective plans require consistent data. And so how do you do this? Thinking about, you know, good projections for rainfall and sea level rise that we have confidence in that we can be using in decision-making. And where does this lead us? I think sometimes the conversation about, you know, the modeling and the data can sometimes feel dry. You know, by training, I'm an infrastructure finance expert, so I like to see what this can build. And I think the real vision here is, how can Florida be a national leader in resilience innovation? Right now across the country, often when folks want, you know, to understand how to deal with these challenges, they go to our friends the Dutch or other folks like that. And my sincere hope is that in 5 years, when people want true cutting edge expertise, they're going to firms in Florida to export expertise, because you all have really cemented kind of yourselves as a leader in resilience innovation. And I think the result is not just kind of data or models, but real projects turning dirt in communities that are at the cutting edge. So what could this mean, you know, for next year? I think there's incredible work that you all have done in Always Ready. I think themes that we see, you know, many states considering after they start big programs like this is how to consistently try to get better quality projects. There's many good projects, but thinking about how do you continue to enable communities to really develop good project ideas and rapidly move towards execution so that these are not just conversations, but projects in the ground that protect people, and that every dollar goes as far as possible, and you're thinking about projects that have multiple uses. How do we support highly impacted communities and really make sure that financially distressed communities have access to planning and implementation funds? And how do you make sure that there's the highest quality data? So I'll wrap it up. We have a team of 30 working on this across states. These are some of my colleagues here, and you know, would love to answer any questions now or afterwards. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for that presentation, Ms. Roberts. Members, do we have any questions? Any questions, members? Vice Chair Roffler for a question.
Thank you, Chair. And you know, when it comes to water, you can count on me for a question.
That's right. I can always count on you for
That's right. So I appreciate your presentation. One thing that was interesting to me, you start off at the very beginning, was telling us who some of the partners were. Any way we can get a list? I think you said there was 7 congressmen and a whole list of people that are partners. Could you explain again a little bit what that coalition of elected officials was, and can we get a list of that?
Ms. Roberts, you're recognized.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Absolutely, I'm happy to follow up with a full list, and I'll mention, so we're a coalition, it's completely free to join. It's a coalition of the willing for cities and towns, you know, of which there are 70. Most of those have passed a non-binding resolution to join and just say that they want to be able to work with us. And then on the elected official side, we have elected officials join everything from mayors to county executives to, you know, a few governors to members of Congress on both sides of the aisle. And I'd love to follow up and give you a list.
Thank you for that, Ms. Roberts. Representative Hanchowski with a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I had a question on the stuff that you show that Texas has been doing, where you said under statewide standards, they do flood disclosure. What are some of the elements that would be important in a flood disclosure?
Yeah, I'll just go back there. That's a great question. And I will say, I think Texas probably has one of the best policies in the country there. So they're really thinking about making sure that they're covering, you know, levees that could have overflows, not just whether you're in a floodplain or not, but really whether the home has flooded, you know, what could happen if a levee has to be, you know, over, you know, could overtop, if you're in an area that they could decide to release water into. And so I think it's pretty comprehensive. And one thing I will say about what happened in Texas is this happened after Hurricane Harvey, and it was actually led by the Houston Partnership, which is their business kind of chamber of commerce group, and the realtors in Texas. So they really found a way to approach this that brought together all stakeholders and, you know, had quite a lot of support, and they found that it hasn't had kind of many negative consequences. So I think that's something really to take from there, is it's great to bring everyone to the table, our friends at the Chambers of Commerce, our friends in the realtor community, and others, to really craft a robust policy.
Members, questions? See no further questions. Ms. Roberts, thank you very much for that presentation. And by the way, I actually had a couple coming into this, but then I saw the presentation slides, and you answered them all. So I think that's That's a compliment to you. Thank you guys for what you're doing, and thank you for the thank you for being here with us today. Members, that concludes our presentations here today. I was going to recognize two members. Representative Busada Cabrera, who I think just stepped out. You know, she was very influential in the Always Ready, getting that across the finish line, as well as Representative Honchowski has also been a big advocate for some of this resiliency work. So I wanted to acknowledge you both. You guys have both worked very hard in the past on some of these issues, and thank you very much for that. Members, that concludes our presentations for the day. Thank you guys for hanging in there. You guys even had some great questions. So thank you guys, and I hope you guys have a great evening. We'll look forward to seeing you next week. And by the way, some good news. We'll be seeing our first bills next week. So let's look to next week, members. That being said, the committee, see no further business before the committee. Representative Butana moves we rise.